Aloha, Rick Sengaria, Vermont Edition. This podcast has been edited for brevity. So enjoy. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Eve's Cidery and its corresponding orchards nestle into the Finger Lakes region of New York State. Actually, cider makers Autumn Stochek and Ezra Sherman break it down even further. One orchard, as they put it on their website, is a 12-acre orchard full of apples planted in the 80s. Quote, "These trees are large, rooted in a deep, dry, gravelly loam, the glacial deposit from the shore of the Ice Age Lake Ithaca. The second site sits perched on a near cliff-like hillside with layers of shale overlain with their silty loam sediment." This is prime apple territory, but it doesn't mean it's easy, for trees or for apple growers, for that matter. But maybe that's what makes them so good for cider. Stochek told author Jason Wilson that the best cider comes from trees that have had to suffer a little bit. "I want tension, struggle, maturity," she says to Wilson in his new book. And it turns out tension, struggle, and maturity are kind of key words throughout the cider industry, from growing the right apples to figuring out the best method to make the cider to getting consumers to value what craft cider makers value in their own product. And Jason Wilson has studied it all. His new book is called The Cider Revival, Dispatches from the Orchard, and he joins us now. Jason, it's a pleasure to have you on Vermont Edition.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
So why might the best cider come from adversity?
Well, I mean, cider is not easy. And a lot of cider is made from the sort of apples you get in the grocery store, the supermarket, Gala or Macintosh, and they're nice and shiny and red. And these are not the apples we want to make good cider. We want sort of these ugly apples, deformed little apples, with brown spots and some very tannic and sometimes bitter and very acidic. And, you know, these are the apples that really give some complexity to cider. And that's what we want.
So it's not just about the apple variety, though. It's also about where it's grown, what the terroir, as we've talked about before on this program and elsewhere.
Absolutely.
But that idea that it might be a little too cold sometimes, or there might be too many pests, that's going to make for a better cider apple, a more bitter, perhaps literally and figuratively, apple.
Absolutely. I mean, apples are to cider what grapes are to wine. And so what varieties are grown and where they're grown and what sites, what places, it's all very important. I mean, cider is apple wine in at the end of the day.
Well, you also write that unlike wine, cider really comes from humble origins and humble places. And, you wax poetic a little bit about this at the beginning of the book, that you're not going to these highbrow, high-scale places necessarily when you go into an orchard where someone's making craft cider. It might be a little bit of a downtrodden community or county, or it might be out of the way, or people might be a little bit less, dare I say, snobby. Although there's plenty of that in the cider industry as well. And so it feels different to you than wine.
It feels different. I mean, there's definitely snobbery everywhere, right? But for sure. I mean, I think the thing with wine is this, exoticism, these far off places, Tuscany or Napa Valley or whatever, places in France. But with cider, there's a sort of nearness. I mean, we've all sort of bobbed for apples and, we've picked, most of us have picked apples or, in the fall, or, and there's this sense that like cider is coming from places where, I don't know, like your aunt and uncle live, or you went to summer camp, or, someplace, very kind of close and American. And there is a sort of, a sort of humbleness to cider, like you're saying.
You mentioned in one scene in the book something that I've been thinking about all week, which is this one orchardist who, or actually it was a cider press, a place where they press cider, that they used to make this cider and take it in tanks in their trucks and actually deliver it into tanks in people's basements. I mean, and we're talking about the 1950s, 60s up until the 70s. 70s, I think. So not
70s,
that long
ago. For sure.
Can you describe that? It was such a wonderful scene.
So this old time cider mill up in the Finger Lakes pretty close to Geneva, and called Gantz Cider Mill, and the whole place runs on the power of a tractor. I mean, they have these pulley systems set up to a tractor, and that's what runs the whole thing. Yeah, and you know, up until maybe 30 or 40 years ago, they would go around, you know, Geneva and Ithaca, and they would sell you like a barrel for $5 and then fill it up. And then, you know, every year they would come back and you'd get your, you know, winter supply of cider in the basement, and they would just pump it in like gas or something, you know, and then the truck would just go door to door, and, you know, everybody had their cider for the winter.
Yeah, it's like getting your home heating oil. I mean, it was like, okay,
exactly.
Well, this is what you do in the autumn. It sounds kind of perfect. But that fell by the wayside. But your whole book is called The Cider Revival, and what you're writing about is this return to cider. It was a drink that was very popular, more popular than water in the colonies, for example. And so, you know, some of the stuff that had died out, maybe not tanks in the basement, but this idea of cider as a drink that we should be experiencing and reveling in is coming back.
It is. And, you know, it's interesting that just that the cider mill that we're talking about is having like a rebirth. Like they're doing more cider today than they were, you know, 10 years ago. I mean, that there's so much because there's so much, so many cider makers, you know, that are on the scene. I mean, the cider, I think cider is a very old thing. Certainly it goes back to early America, but cider as we know it now is a pretty new beverage, really. I mean, craft cider. I mean, Angry Orchard launched in 2011 and kind of created this whole industry, you know, and you know, so we're really only talking about like the craft cider movement kind of dating to like maybe 2011, 2012. I mean, so we're really at the beginning of this, and every year you have dozens more cideries that are kind of popping up. And so it's a really dynamic time, I mean, to be into cider for sure.
Is that just true here in the United States? I mean, I'm married to a Brit who grew up drinking Scrumpy occasionally, which is, you know, sort of cloudy cider from the UK.
Yeah. The UK kind of had their cider revival maybe 10 years ago or so. I mean, it's definitely happened over there. It's more of a thing, I think, in the UK for sure. So we're trailing a little bit behind that. But yeah, it's definitely. And then you see there are a lot of kind of newer producers in Spain you're seeing, you know, especially in northern Spain, like in the Basque region or Asturias, and a little bit in Normandy, although it's pretty traditional there. So. But yeah, you know, it's a somewhat global thing, but I think the real energy is in the U.S. right now.
We're talking with Jason Wilson. His new book is called The Cider Revival, Dispatches from the Orchard. And Jason, you've mentioned Angry Orchard a couple of times now, and Angry Orchard is people will know if they've seen it in the grocery stores. It is basically mass market consumer cider, but you're not necessarily a big fan of it.
Well, I'm trying to remain neutral because, I mean, the fact
you definitely
that
don't
is
remain neutral in the book.
Okay. All right. I'm totally not neutral. But so Angry Orchard is, you know, the 800-pound gorilla for sure. I mean, they hold something like 60% of the cider market in the United States. So, I mean, the book would have failed if it didn't deal with Angry Orchard in some way. I think that's most people's experience with cider. And I think, you know, you mentioned, I would love to hear from someone who thought cider is too dry, because usually you hear that somebody say, oh my God, it's so sweet. You know, I don't like cider. It's sweet. And I had an event last night in the suburbs, and it was the same thing. People came, they showed up to see me, and they were completely unconvinced about cider. And I poured them dry ciders, and they were like, oh my God, we've never had anything like this before. And, you know, it's because they've had these kind of mass market ciders that are sweet. I mean, it's just, there's no way around it. And I think it's a taste that like a lot of people like, but a lot of people don't like. And so, but that's
people
the
must
predominant
like it.
Style.
I mean, if that's what's selling in the, sort of to the lowest common denominator, and I don't mean that in a judgmental way, but in the sort of like, this is what's going to sell to the mass market, people must like it. And when I say, you know, people who may have found it too dry, I think there is, as you've said it, this expectation. If what you've tried is, you know, Angry Orchard or Woodchuck, or if you're thinking of a certain kind of idea of cider, if the first cider you try is a really dry, almost sort of bitter, or makes your, you know, your mouth sort of pucker up a little bit. That may not be an expectation that you have of what a hard cider is. And I can imagine some people might say, ooh, no, that's just not for me.
True. And I'm sure that that's the case. I mean, some of the ciders that I like are very funky, very dry, very acidic. And no, I know that that's not, you know, to everybody's taste for sure.
And, you know, it surprised me a little bit because I think as a Vermonter, you know, we're in the land of woodchuck. And so woodchuck has had a pretty big pretty big footprint here in Vermont when it comes to cider and when it comes to craft beverages. And when you look at like people with big market shares or companies with big market shares and then a company that's selling to an even larger conglomerate. And so, you know, I always think of woodchuck as like big cider. Angry Orchard is leaps and bounds bigger than woodchuck.
Much bigger. I mean, and that's crazy because woodchuck is the number two basically after Angry Orchard. But I remember when woodchuck kind of came out. I was actually in college in Vermont in the 90s when woodchuck kind of came around the first time, and there was a couple hard ciders that they were selling, and they were always pitched as this kind of alternative to beer. And you know, I don't know. I feel like cider is, in some ways, has never really grown out of that. It's always an alternative to something else. You know, it lives in this alternative world where like Zima and Four Loko and Mike's Hard Lemonade and all these weird, like, you know, alternatives are, you know, and it's like a bad crowd that cider got mixed up in, you know, 20 or 30 years ago. And it's kind of only recently begun to break out of that.
Well, what got you interested in cider, given that that's sort of the reputation that cider had, and we're seeing this revival, and you write about small craft producers all over the country, but what made you even think, okay, this is a part of the booze industry that I'm interested in digging into?
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about this a lot as I was in the middle of this, because I'm like, why am I here? But I think I was up in the Finger Lakes, and I was doing some research on a wine book, and there was all of these cider makers that really were committed, like in the same way that these great winemakers were. And it was almost like a cider region, like a wine region was emerging around the Finger Lakes. You had like seven or eight producers that were really kind of like, they were rivals, they were collaborators, they were, you know, kind of, there was this whole group that was kind of pushing each other. And I just was really fascinated by that world. And then it was also, happening in Vermont as well, you know, and those are sort of the two, you know, locuses of this, you know, and I don't know, the world was really fascinating, the world of these orchards and people trying to grow these old apple varieties and finding new apple varieties. And it just was like a very rich story, I felt like. So that's why I got kind of hooked on it.
Sarah writes in on Twitter to say, does the book consider Quebec? The revival is really real here and very legislated. And Sarah is writing to us from Quebec.
Yes. I mean, there's not a lot about Quebec. I mean, it's mentioned, but I didn't explore that. I mean, it is sort of, no, I didn't. I mean, I know there's a lot going on up there as well, for sure.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because Canada and Quebec in particular have really different ways that agriculture is regulated. And when it comes to milk or maple syrup, it's a very different system. And I wonder if it's the same for cider and for apples. And I don't know much about the liquor industry and hard beverage industry in Quebec, but it might be the same there, too, that, you know, as Sarah points out, it's very legislated. Could be a kind of a different approach to dealing with that in Canada, Jason.
Right, right. Well, I think that, you know, cider is big anywhere where it's like that there's great apples. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's a terroir drink. So, I mean, everybody's rediscovering, you know, local cheeses, local, you know, local foods, local produce, you know, and you know, so cider just kind of goes along with that to me. So I'm sure, you know, I know that there's a big cider scene in Montreal and you know, and it's all locally made stuff. So, I mean, that makes sense. And I mean, that's the way it is in Vermont and out in Portland and Seattle. And, you know, it's that's just the way it goes.
Let's go to Earl, who's calling in from Corinth. Hi, Earl. You're on the air.
Hi, yeah, thank you very much. And I got to say, your author's totally right. We've got some old apple trees, and just we've been pruning them back a little bit. And just use a real variety, the old gnarly apples, and it just makes the best cider because it just, the thing I like about it, it just tastes so alive. And luckily, this year is a good apple year. Last year, not so good, but this year I'm looking at getting, you know, 15, 25 gallons of cider. And you just got a small hand press, and it's just It's so much fun to press and then so good to drink.
Earl, what kind of apples are you growing for your cider?
That was my
question.
Well,
they're just old apple trees that were just out on the land, and we just pruned them back a little bit. I have no idea what the varieties are. There's some little red, some little greens, just a whole variety, some sort of yellow ones. And when we mix it up, when we make use all the varieties together when we press it, that's when it's best. If you use just one variety at a time, not as good. There's something about the blending of it that really makes it amazing.
Earl, thank you very much for calling, and your orchard sounds wonderful. Jason, that sounds very familiar.
That's a great call, yeah.
Yeah.
It does. And I love that he doesn't know the apple varieties, because that's what happens a lot of times. A lot of the cider makers that I've been out with, you know, they'll go foraging out in the, you know, in the forest or whatever, and they find these great trees. They love the apples, and they just kind of name the apples themselves. You know, because they have no name. They're just wild apples. And, you know, so this is like, you know, Earl's right. I would love to taste some of that cider. I'm sure it's very good.
Yeah, and some of the cider makers are really using that idea of feral apples or wild apples or abandoned orchards as a selling point. I mean, Shaxbury here in Vermont has been doing it for years and is experimenting with actually taking some of the cuttings from those apple trees and making their own orchards out of them. Other cider makers that you write about in New York State are really going, you know, all through their communities trying to find people with an apple tree that they can pick their apples off of. It's kind of a neat difference between some of the other beverage industry, ways of producing their beverage.
For sure. I mean, the thing is that there's just such a shortage of good cider apples because they've all been, you know, cut down over the years. You know, the basic apples rule. And so, right, to source the apples, all the cider makers are always running around, whether it's the wild apples or, right, some neighbor of theirs that has, you know, four crab apple trees in the backyard that they want those, you know. And so they're always like the whole fall is this, chase to find great apples for a lot of them.
Lots of people sharing thoughts on apples and cider and questions about growing methods for apples and how to make really good cider, as well as their thoughts on where the industry is and how it fits into their lives and their drinking habits. And let's actually talk to somebody who's very influential and very well known throughout the cider industry in the Northeast. Steve Wood is often considered a mentor or an aspirational goal for aspiring cider makers. He and his wife and partner, Louisa Spencer, own Farnham Hill Ciders and Poverty Lane Orchards in Lebanon, New Hampshire. And he's been growing apples there for decades and in the late 80s started cultivating apples specifically for making cider. He's on the line with us now. Steve, nice to talk with you again.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, you know, you often say that you're really an apple grower first and cider is sort of a necessary byproduct. What do you mean by that?
Exactly what the words mean. I mean, I've been growing apples on the same piece of ground for 50 years. We started growing cider apples out of curiosity and then eventually out of necessity if we wanted to keep growing apples at all. You know, we had to learn how to make cider. I think we've done a reasonable job of learning how to make cider. But, we're still fundamentally growers. We're people with our fingers in the ground. Dirt, by which I mean.
Do you agree with the idea that the best cider comes from apple trees that have had to struggle a little bit, have a little adversity?
Boy, that's a complex question. yes, but not like grapes. I mean, not really stressed out. They are not the same plant, and some of the analogies that are used between them are, I think, mistaken. The other way around, it is that if you grow a cider apple the way people are obliged to grow dessert apples, eating apples now, which is big, colorful, and hard and whatever, and they're planted in wheat-free strips with fertigation, meaning water and water and fertilizer dosed to each tree in order to get the great big apples. For cider, you get bags of water. So we don't think that's the way to grow cider fruit. But we don't deliberately neglect the trees and just let them struggle with the elements.
You don't look askance at them, sort of yell at them, try to make them feel bad?
Somebody caught me years ago with my back against an apple tree drinking out of a bottle of whiskey and pouring a little of it on the ground for the tree. I mean, I'm afraid I have my whole life anthropomorphized trees. I mean, it's kind of a hopeless disease. It's kind of like a heroin addiction or something. We think you should take care of the trees and listen to them. But, you know, it's also not, we're not wandering around caressing 15,000 trees and asking them what they want or individually.
One of the things, Steve, that you're known for is being really profligate with advice and with cuttings that you give people who want to start up their own orchard or start being a cider maker. You'll give them cuttings from your trees. And we haven't talked about the way apples work, but we've talked about that in previous shows, that you can't just have a seed and hope that it's going to be the same apple that its parent tree was. But I'm curious, because as the industry grows, and Jason Wilson is talking about all of these different cider makers that are coming up, and you're giving them all cuttings, how do you see that sort of divide or tension between being collegial and being friendly or being competitive?
We figured out a long time ago that we were growing these apples for the purpose, a lot of them inedible, trying to find some place to sell the cider, which was getting well reviewed in like 2001 or something by the Times and Food and Wine or whatever, but nobody was actually buying it. And we realized that the problem was not that the cider, I mean, all these sommeliers and winiacs and foodies were raving about how great it was. It had no category. There was no place for it. And we were out there with Woodchuck, our dear old friend's Woodchuck, making completely different ciders from Woodchuck, but both sort of holding down our side of the fort. We realized that we needed to develop a category of orchard-based ciders, and that, we are highly opinionated about this, and nobody else had an opinion at all, but that good ciders depend on the fruit from which they're made. Complex orchard-based ciders, that is unequivocally true of. And we thought we would be better off working to develop colleagues across the country, who, particularly ones who are already know how to grow apple trees, growing apple trees is a long haul, man. I mean, we knew that we were not embarking on a two-year voyage, but we needed more good cider based on good apples. Now, here's the thing I'm feeling a little contrite about, is that that's why we give fruit away. And we arrogantly think, that we can stay, we can win the game of King on the Hill, but you can't play King on the Hill on a pane of glass. That is, we need more people making stuff. And we have it now, to making stuff really based on orchards. This has evolved over the last decade or two. But giving things out, I guess we just think we gain more first from, in the early days, getting the category going at all, because there was no place for our cider if we didn't do that. Second, collegiality is just a very valuable thing. And the people we give stuff to, it's not like there's no reciprocation. We've gotten very good advice about other things from other people. People call us for advice, and we always chuckle a little bit because we don't think we know what we're doing. But, we give it freely, but always with a caveat that we don't think we know what we're doing. And meanwhile, we have had the privilege of picking all kinds of friendly people's brains because it's part of our nature, I guess. It just makes better sense to be collegial than it does to be protective.
Well, and Jason Wilson, you write in the book that you find that happening all throughout the industry. This is not just Steve Wood being the only person who's nice inside, or a lot of people are giving scions or are even starting, giving them to growers, like to tree growers, so that other people who want to buy a tree with this kind of apple can buy it.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the cider world is incredibly nice. It's much nicer than the world of, wine or beer or cocktails or whatever. I mean, the people are incredibly, open and, yeah, I mean, it's just amazing. Like, somebody will, have be have grafted a tree from, you know, a wild apple or whatever. And then, you know, after a few years, they'll have just kind of give it to a nursery and make it available to dozens of others. And so I think that like this process that Steve kind of kicked off, you know, where he's, you know, shared his cuttings and everything. I mean, I think it's really great. I mean, it's something that is, throughout the industry.
Steve, we haven't talked too much about the tension between what's often called modern cider, so these big, sweet, mass-market ciders like Angry Orchard or Woodchuck, and what you call orchard-based ciders, what's sometimes called heritage cider, and you know people sort of bicker about the names. But there does seem like there's a pretty big divide between these sweet, big ciders that are often made from apple juice concentrate versus orchard-based ciders like yours. And but I understand you're actually doing a collaboration in a can, which is another big debate, with Woodchuck called Odd Crush. So it seems like an odd pairing. How did that come about?
It came about because, you know, I mean, you could easily argue that in this corner of the country, in two states who can't agree about the Connecticut River or which one's upside down and which one's right side up, and, you know, which one's the real deal and which one isn't. And it's sort of, you know, have a love-hate relationship that goes back forever. Two cideries started that could be argued to have started the whole damn thing. Woodchuck, I mean, I knew Joe Sonilia before he started Woodchuck back in the 90s. You know, he bought an orchard in Vermont, whatever. Even he was a Bond guy, but rest in peace. But they've been pals of ours forever. And the fact is that, you know, they went down one road, and we went down another. We're growers. They are not growers. They have certainly made great relationships with Vermont growers. But, you know, they made the appley sweet stuff that you're describing. And we made stuff based on the fruit we grow from this land. Their stuff was in six packs, not very expensive, of 12-ounce bottles. Our stuff was in 750-milliliter wine bottles. That's just been true the whole time. And then suddenly, I mean, we really did, the two of us, a fair bit to get this funny industry starting. And as you say, I mean, Woodchuck has more or less gotten smoked by Angry Orchard. Meanwhile, we're still sitting over here trying to figure out how and why the definition of artisanal cider has become the flavor of the month and, you know, Chipotle maple aardvark blood instead of, you know, people, when we get these weird calls from Food and Wine Press now that what's new at Farnham Hill? And the answer is, I don't understand the question. Another crop. The reason is we've been friends for a long time. And I'll tell you the truth. This was hatched at a bar between Ben Calvi, their president, and me. And it was just basically, what should we just do something? And we both thought it would be funny. We both thought that it would be fun. And it was unbelievably difficult to make a cider that was somehow reflective of Woodchuck's flagship and our flagship. And still anything like good to drink. Wow. I think we did a pretty good job. But they're amazingly good at what they do. You know, I think we're marginally good at what we do as well, and we didn't really have anything to lose.
Yeah, and you know, if it works, it works. I look forward to tasting it. And we're going to let you go here, Steve, because I know we pulled you out of the orchard. Steve Wood runs Farnham Hill Ciders and Poverty Lane Orchards in Lebanon, New Hampshire, with his wife, Louisa Spencer. Steve, nice to talk with you again.
Thank you very much, and good luck, Jason, with that book. It's a good one.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it.
So what do you think about that? Jason, you write at one point in the book when another cider maker was thinking about doing a project with, I think it was with Angry Orchard, and you wrote back, despite your professed neutrality, please don't do that. So what do you think yes. about somebody like Steve Wood, who is held up as this, you know, orchard-based heritage cider partnering with one of the big guys?
Well, I think that Steve Wood, I mean, you've just heard from him. I think the force of his personality would, you know, he'd be able to, of anyone, to kind of, you know, hold the line with one of the bigger ciders to get something pretty good, you know, in a can. So, I mean, I would trust that could happen for sure. But I don't know. I'm a little bit, as you say, I'm a little bit ambivalent about these kinds of projects, to be honest with you. I'm one of these people that loves the artisan cider. I love the artisan aspect of it. And, you know, maybe I'm a cider snob. I don't know.
Karen writes in to say, I started drinking cider in the early 2000s, and I loved Woodchuck Dark and Dry. Since then, the market has grown, and there are so many incredible options with locally grown apples. My husband and I have made our own cider for many years now and have come to appreciate many heirloom varieties. Those that might not be suitable for snacking make the best cider. Molly says, cider is basically the only thing I drink. I love to collect bottles from every unique cider I try. I love how different each type of cider can be. Stowe Cider is my absolute favorite cidery. That's what will be served at the bar at my upcoming wedding. And Stephen in Jamaica is back on the line with us. Stephen, hi, I think we've got you on the air. What do you want to talk about?
Hi. Well, my wife and I recently bought some property and found out, much to our great surprise, that 100 years ago it had been an apple orchard. And we've got wild apple trees dotted around the property, but we've also planted some more modern trees, specifically Honeycrisp, that we wanted to use those apples and mix them with the old apples, because we don't have a tremendous amount of the old apples. Are we doing ourselves a disservice in trying to combine those apples to make cider?
Stephen, thanks for the call. So, you know, Jason Wilson, you're not a cider maker yourself, but what do you think?
I mean, I don't think that, like, it's immediately a bad idea. There's a lot of good cider that's maybe has a base of culinary apples. Like, maybe it has a Macintosh base that has some, you know, some crab apple or some heirloom apple that's blended in, you know. So I don't think it's, like, you know, it's a terrible idea. Although, I mean, if he's got apples like that, I know a few cider makers that would like to pay a visit if he wants to sell the apples, for sure. But any you know, property that is an abandoned orchard is like, you know, music to the ears of a lot of the cider makers I know.
Well, actually, we got a question from Mary who says, if we have some of those wild apple trees, how can we offer them to cider makers?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, definitely. I mean, the people are looking for sure. So, I mean, if there's, you know, if they just reach out, I mean, on social media or, you know, definitely put the offer out there and somebody will come get them, I'm sure.
Yes, just post on your local front porch forum. I have apples. Somebody will come find them.
Cider apples. Please take them.
Jason, in reading your book, I wrote down, you know, here's where I see the big fights or the tensions and the challenges that are being worked out within the industry. And I wrote down methods, like, are you using the champagne method? Are you using a different method? Modern versus heritage. Apple growers trying to suss out long-term trends, because, of course, this is an agricultural product and it takes a long time to get your trees even up to the point where they're producing apples. How to get consumers interested in more than just sweet, snobbery, and cans. Am I missing anything from the tension within the industry?
Naming styles, you know, inner scene rivalries, you know, I don't know.
Mousiness.
Yes, mousiness, you know, is it too funky?
So before we let you go, one of the other things that, you know, that has matured with the beer industry is that with beers, you're now at a point where you can look at a menu, and even if you're unfamiliar with that particular brewery or even, you know, maybe even the type of beer, having a style listed, maybe an alcohol percentage, maybe even the hop scale can lead you to get a drink that you're at least somewhat likely to enjoy. You know, you kind of know a little bit about what you're getting. Are we close to that with cider?
We're getting there, but I think, yeah, I mean, I think that that's something that really, like, you know, the United States Association of Cider Makers is doing this, like, lexicon project now. I mean, we're still in the phase of, like, naming certain styles and agreeing what a certain style is. So I think we're a few years away from that, like, where, you know, if you get a Saison or an IPA or whatever, you kind of know what you're getting in New England style IPA or whatever. You know, we're not quite there yet for sure. I mean, this is still, we're still maybe a decade away from that, I would think, with cider.
But it's coming, you think?
I hope so. I mean, I think so. I think that, you know, there's definitely more of an interest in it. And I, you know, I just know from when I pour these, people get excited about them. So, you know, I do think it's coming eventually.
Jason Wilson's latest book is called The Cider Revival, Dispatches from the Orchard. He's got a lot of appearances tied to the book release, and we'll put a link up at vpr.org. Jason, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. It's great.
And that's it for today. We're still getting mail from our earlier conversation, though, about cider and the cider revival. Terza says, thank you for the perfect almost fall discussion. I love fresh cider, non-alcoholic, and have all of my life. When I turned 21, I was so excited to find such a thing as hard cider, an alcoholic drink I would actually like. Well, I've tried many now, but have yet to find one I really love, not the way I love traditional cider. I do normally like sweet, but neither the mainstream brands nor the smaller brands have made me say, yum, I'd buy this again. Champlain Orchard has come close, but I hope I will not forever be searching for the I love this hard cider. Jonathan says, here in Shrewsbury, we have a number of good cider makers and occasionally have cider tastings at Pierce's General Store. Tim says, well, as Benjamin Franklin said, in wine there is wisdom, in beer there is freedom, in water there is bacteria. A lovely expression of our early preferences for anything other than water. And Joe finally writes in, forget Angry Orchard and Woodchuck. My go-to cider is Harpoon, now called City Roots. It's just got one ingredient, fermented apple juice. Not too sweet, not too dry. And a 12-pack is under $20. Pure cider goodness that won't break the bank. Great show. You can listen back to it by going to vpr.org or subscribe to our podcast.